Welcome to another deep dive. We're going to be tackling the book of Joshua today.
Okay.
Specifically, that epic conquest of Canaan. We're kind of picking up where we left off in our Exodus discussion. Remember those incredible victories at Jericho and Ai?
Yeah.
Well, that was just the tip of the spear.
It really was just the beginning. Those early wins were crucial, but they really just set the stage for a much larger campaign. I think to understand what unfolds next, we need to shift our focus to Shechem.
Shechem.
Yeah. It's not just any location. It's where Joshua renews the covenant between God and the Israelites.
Hold on. Covenant renewal.
Yeah.
Why is it such a big deal? It feels a bit like a legal formality, right?
Not quite. It's much more significant than that. Picture this. The Israelites, fresh from their victories, gather at Shechem. They're surrounded by these imposing mountains, Ebal and Gerizim. Joshua builds an altar there, following the instructions laid out in Deuteronomy, and then reads the law aloud to everyone. This is more than just paperwork. It's a powerful declaration of their commitment to God and a recognition that possessing the land is directly tied to their obedience. Blessings if they stay faithful, curses if they stray.
Oh, wow.
A stark choice laid out right at the start of their conquest.
So it's not just about military victories. It's about understanding that there are serious strings attached to this promised land deal.
Right.
But then things get a little tricky with the Gibeonites, right?
Mm-hmm.
Weren't they trying to pull a fast one?
Absolutely. The Gibeonites, realizing that they can't defeat the Israelites in a head-to-head confrontation, come up with this really cunning plan to survive. They show up pretending to be travelers from a distant land.
Oh, wow.
Wearing worn-out clothes, carrying moldy bread the whole nine yards.
It's like about commitment to the bit.
Yeah.
But it worked, didn't it?
It did. And it throws a serious wrench into things. Back then, treaties and oaths were absolutely sacred. The Israelites, without seeking divine guidance this time, fall for the ruse and end up in a binding treaty with the Gibeonites guaranteeing their protection.
Oh boy, I bet that came back to bite them. You can't just break an oath in the ancient world,
yeah,
even if it was made under false pretenses.
Exactly. And that's precisely what sets the stage for a major conflict with five Amorite kings who are furious about this treaty. They see it as a betrayal and a threat to their regional power.
So now the Israelites are stuck between a rock and a hard place.
Yeah.
They can't break their oath, but they also can't stand by and watch their new allies get crushed. What did they do?
They chose to honor their commitment. Joshua leads the Israelite army to defend the Gibeonites, engaging the Amorite kings in this fierce battle. And that's when things get really interesting. The sun standing still.
Wait, hold on. The sun actually stopped moving. That's the kind of story that sparks endless debate, isn't it?
Oh, you're telling me. It's one of those biblical events that has captivated and challenged readers for centuries. There are a few main ways people interpret this sun standing still event. Some view it as a rationalistic legend, essentially a story that developed to explain a victory that felt unexplainable. Maybe there was a natural phenomenon that people couldn't quite grasp at the time.
So like an ancient game of telephone, the story evolved into something more dramatic.
Right, exactly.
Oh, that makes sense. What are the other interpretations?
Well, there's the poetic expression view. This one suggests that the language is figurative, meant to convey the enormity of God's intervention, not a literal stopping of the sun and moon. It could even be a subjective experience of time, you know, those moments when you're so engrossed in something that time seems to melt away.
Oh, yeah, I've definitely been there. But what about those who take a more literal approach?
There are those who believe it happened exactly as the text describes. Within that group, you've got folks who think it was a literal stopping of the Earth's rotation. While others lean towards a miracle of light refraction, maybe the light rays bent in a way that made it look like the sun and moon were frozen in place.
Those are some wild possibilities. I never thought about it that way. Didn't a scholar, H.B. Blair, offer a totally different take, something about darkness?
Yeah. Blair proposes that Joshua might have been asking for the opposite of extended daylight. He points out that the Israelites had just finished an all-night march before this battle.
Okay.
And there's mention of a hailstorm during the fight.
Right.
He says that maybe the Hebrew word translated as stand still could also mean to cease or be silent, referring to the sun's light rather than its movement.
So instead of the sun literally stopping, it's more like a prolonged darkness caused by the storm, giving the Israelites an advantage and adding to the chaos for the Amorites. That's a fascinating new angle I hadn't considered before.
It definitely throws a curveball into the traditional interpretations, doesn't it?
Yeah.
But no matter how you interpret the miracle, the outcome is the same. The five kings are defeated, forced to flee and hide in a cave at Makeda. And the detail about those rocks placed over the cave entrance, a monument to this day,
right,
adds a tangible layer to the story, doesn't it?
It's like a physical echo of this ancient victory. It makes you wonder what other traces of these events might still be hidden, waiting to be discovered. But this victory over the five kings was just the beginning, wasn't it? What happened next?
Well, the Israelites continued their southern campaign, taking city after city. Lachish, Eglon, Hebron, Debir, they all fell one by one.
Wow.
And the text doesn't shy away from the brutality of these conquests.
Yeah, it's hard to miss those descriptions of leaving no survivors and destroying all who breathed,
yeah,
as God commanded.
Yeah.
It definitely raises some tough questions about the nature of warfare in the ancient world.
It's a challenging and complex aspect of the narrative, no doubt about it. But for now, let's shift our focus to the northern campaign, where we encounter a rather intriguing detail.
Yeah.
The command to hamstring horses and burn chariots. What do you make of that?
That's an interesting one. It feels almost counterintuitive from a military standpoint. Why cripple your own resources? It's like they're intentionally limiting their military might.
Exactly. And that's precisely the point. It highlights a crucial theme running through the Old Testament, trusting in God rather than human strength.
Okay.
The victory is attributed to divine intervention, not superior weaponry or military strategy.
It reminds me of that verse in Psalms. Some trust in chariots and some in horses, but we trust in the name of the Lord our God.
That's a perfect connection. And this tension between relying on human strength versus relying on God's power plays out throughout biblical history, doesn't it?
It definitely does. We see it later with the monarchy when King David initially follows Joshua's example, hamstringing most of the horses he captures. But then his son Solomon goes in a completely different direction, amassing thousands of horses and chariots,
right,
seemingly prioritizing earthly power. And of course, the prophets later condemn this shift, calling Israel back to dependence on God. It's fascinating to see how this tension plays out over generations.
It really is. But for now, let's return to that northern campaign. Empowered by God, the Israelites defeat a powerful coalition, solidifying their control over this vast territory. In fact, Joshua 11.23 states that Joshua took the entire land, fulfilling God's promise. But then, there's a bit of a head-scratcher, isn't there?
Oh, yeah, I remember this. Just a few chapters later, Joshua 13.1 opens with a rather perplexing statement. There are still very large areas of land to be taken over. So which is it? Did they conquer the whole land, or was there still more fighting to be done?
It seems like a contradiction, but it might actually point to a two-stage conquest. Think of those initial campaigns, both in the south and the north, as decisive blows that broke the back of major Canaanite resistance. They established Israelite dominance, but not complete control.
So it's like those shock and awe tactics we see in modern warfare.
Yes.
A rapid, overwhelming force that cripples the enemy's ability to resist. But it doesn't necessarily mean every single pocket of resistance has been eliminated.
A great analogy. Those early victories didn't equate to immediate and total control over every inch of territory. There were still battles to be fought and skirmishes to win to fully subdue the land and eliminate any remaining pockets of resistance.
It makes you wonder what challenges emerged from this two-stage conquest. Did it create ongoing tension and conflict? Did it make it harder to establish a unified nation?
Those are great questions, and ones we'll definitely be exploring further as we delve deeper into the book. But before we get ahead of ourselves, let's not forget about the division of the spoils.
Okay.
After these major campaigns, the land is carefully allocated among the 12 tribes, right?
Right. And this wasn't just a free-for-all land grab. It was a meticulously planned process laid out in detail in Joshua chapters 13 through 22.
Absolutely. The text provides detailed descriptions of the tribal boundaries, listing specific cities and landmarks. It's like a treasure trove of information for anyone interested in historical geography.
Wow.
But amidst all those geographical details, there's one key element that jumps out, the location of the tabernacle.
You're talking about its establishment in Shiloh, right?
Yeah.
That central location was significant, wouldn't you say?
I think so. It became a spiritual hub for the Israelites. It's almost like a physical manifestation of God's presence dwelling among his people in this newly conquered land. But the story doesn't end there, does it? We can't forget about Joshua's farewell address.
Right. As Joshua prepares to leave the scene, he delivers this powerful message to the Israelites. It's a blend of warnings, encouragement, and a final call to faithfulness.
It is.
It's that pivotal moment when the leader passes the torch,
yeah,
reflecting on the journey so far and preparing the people for what lies ahead. What stands out to you from Joshua's farewell?
Well, in chapters 23 and 24, we see Joshua, now old and nearing the end of his life, gathering the Israelites and reminding them of all that God has done for them. It's a powerful recounting of their history, highlighting God's deliverance and faithfulness.
Right.
But he doesn't sugarcoat things. He also issues a stark warning. If you turn away from God, if you disobey his commands and chase after other gods, you will face the consequences.
It's that classic choose wisely moment.
Yeah.
The gift of the land comes with a responsibility, a commitment to stay true to the one who gave it to them. Obedience isn't optional. It's essential.
Right.
And to drive this point home, he orchestrates this dramatic covenant renewal ceremony at Shechem.
Yes. This ceremony echoes the one we discussed earlier, further solidifying the covenant between God and the Israelites. It's interesting to note that both covenant renewals follow a similar structure, mirroring the ancient Hittite treaty form.
Wait, Hittite treaty form? What's that all about?
Well, it's basically like a formal agreement between a king and his vassals, outlining the terms of their relationship. These treaties had specific elements: a preamble, a historical prologue outlining past favors, stipulations for the future, oaths, witnesses, and even a written document. And the covenant renewals in Joshua mirror this structure.
So it's like God is the great king and the Israelites are his vassals.
Exactly.
That's a powerful way to frame their relationship.
Absolutely. It emphasizes the Israelites' dependence on God and their obligation to obey his commands. This covenant renewal ceremony at Shechem serves as a fitting culmination of Joshua's leadership, setting the stage for the next chapter in Israel's story.
It's like the end of one act and the beginning of another. We've covered a lot of ground in this first part of our deep dive, from battles and conquests to covenants and tricky treaties. But before we wrap things up, I'm curious to hear your take on something. This whole idea of a two-stage conquest, what implications do you think it had for the Israelites as they tried to establish themselves in this new land? Did it contribute to future conflicts or internal divisions?
That's a great question. It's definitely something to ponder as we move into the next part of our discussion. The conquest wasn't just a one-and-done event. It was a process, a long and complicated journey that shaped the Israelites' identity and their destiny.
We've given you a lot to think about so far, and we're just getting started. We'll be back soon to dive even deeper into the theological and ethical implications of the conquest, explore the challenges of leadership, and unpack the enduring relevance of the Book of Joshua for our lives today. Stay tuned. We left off talking about that two-stage conquest and all the lingering questions it brings up. But before we go there, I think we need to circle back to one of the most challenging aspects of the Book of Joshua, something that's been weighing on me, the whole concept of harem, the complete destruction of entire populations. It's tough to reconcile that with the image of a loving and merciful God.
Yeah, it's definitely not an easy topic. It's something that has troubled readers for centuries. But I think one thing to consider is that the ancient world was a brutal place. Warfare was conducted with a ferocity that would shock most people today.
You're not kidding. Peace talks and treaties weren't exactly the norm back then.
Right. But the Book of Joshua isn't just reflecting this ancient brutality. It's viewing these events through a specific theological lens. The conquest is presented as God's judgment on the Canaanites for their wickedness. And this judgment wasn't just a sudden whim. It was actually foretold centuries earlier, back in Genesis 15.16. God told Abraham that his descendants would inherit the land, but not until the iniquity of the Amorites is full.
So it's not just about conquering land. It's about God upholding his moral order, dealing with the sin and evil that had corrupted the land and its people. It almost feels like a cosmic cleanup, right?
It's a powerful image, isn't it? And it's important to understand that this wasn't a snap judgment. The Canaanites weren't caught off guard. The text suggests that they had ample opportunity to repent and change their ways, but they persisted in their idolatry, their violence, and their social injustices.
And their actions had consequences not just for themselves, but for the land itself. This idea that the land could be defiled by sin is a theme that comes up again and again in the Old Testament.
Yeah.
It makes you think about our responsibility to care for the environment, doesn't it?
It really does. The land wasn't just a commodity. It was sacred. A gift from God. And there was an expectation that people would live in a way that honored both the land and the giver of the land. But even if we accept that God was justified in judging the Canaanites, the method of judgment, the total destruction, is still incredibly difficult to grapple with. It feels so harsh.
I struggle with that too. It makes you question how much we can really understand the ways of God. We talked about anticipated eschatology before, this idea that the events of the conquest foreshadow the final judgment, the day of the Lord when God deals with all sin and evil. Do you think that perspective helps make sense of Haran?
It's definitely one way to frame it. From that perspective, the destruction of the Canaanites, however difficult it is for us to comprehend, can be seen as a specific and limited instance of a broader principle. There are consequences for rejecting God and persisting in wickedness.
So it's not about God taking pleasure in wiping out entire populations. It's about recognizing that there's a moral order to the universe, and ultimately, justice will be served. Kind of like karma on a cosmic scale.
That's an interesting way to put it. And it's not just an Old Testament concept. This idea of a final judgment is woven throughout the New Testament as well. Jesus himself speaks of a coming day of reckoning when everyone will be held accountable for their actions. And the book of Revelation certainly doesn't shy away from vivid descriptions of God's judgment.
It's a sobering thought. But while the specific details of Haran might be unique to the ancient world and the conquest narrative, the underlying principle that God is ultimately just and will deal with sin is a thread that runs throughout the entire Bible. But what about the Israelites' role in carrying out this judgment? Were they just following orders, or did they have a moral responsibility in all of this?
That's a crucial question. And I think the text offers some clues. Remember, the Israelites were constantly being reminded that victory came not from their own strength or military prowess, but from God's power.
They were like instruments in God's hands carrying out his will.
Exactly. But they weren't passive instruments. They had to choose to obey, to trust God's promises, and to act in accordance with his commands.
So there's an element of both divine sovereignty and human responsibility. That's a complex dance.
Absolutely. God was directing the conquest, but he also held the Israelites accountable for their actions. If they disobeyed, if they allowed greed or cruelty to motivate them, there were consequences.
The story of Achan is a prime example of this, right? He takes some of the plunder from Jericho that was supposed to be dedicated to God, and because of his actions, the Israelites suffer a major defeat at Ai. His disobedience had ripple effects that impacted the whole community.
Right. Achan's story highlights the fact that even though they were instruments of divine judgment, they were still responsible for their own choices and actions. There's a personal accountability that can't be ignored.
It reminds me of that saying, we can't always choose the music life plays for us, but we can choose how we dance to it. Even in the midst of a divinely ordained mission, there's still room for personal integrity. But speaking of choice, there's another aspect of the conquest that often gets overlooked. Those non-Israelites who ended up joining the Israelite community.
You're thinking of people like Rahab, the prostitute from Jericho, and the Gibeonites who tricked the Israelites into that treaty.
Exactly. Their stories are fascinating to me. It shows that God's grace wasn't limited to the Israelites. Even those who had been enemies could find acceptance and a place within the community of faith.
Yeah, their inclusion really challenges a simplistic reading of the conquest, doesn't it? It suggests that the conquest wasn't just about establishing a racially pure nation or wiping out everyone who wasn't an Israelite. It was about God drawing people to himself, regardless of their background or their past.
It's a powerful reminder that God's love and mercy transcend boundaries, and it foreshadows the New Testament message of salvation for all nations, where God's grace is extended to both Jew and Gentile through faith in Jesus Christ.
Right. And it raises some interesting questions about how we define us and them today. Who are the outsiders in our own time? Who are we excluding?
Those are big questions, ones that we could spend a whole deep dive exploring. But for now, let's turn our attention to another key figure in this story, Joshua himself. He's not just a military commander. He's a leader who faces immense challenges and bears tremendous responsibility. What leadership qualities stand out to you in the book of Joshua?
Well, first and foremost, Joshua's leadership is characterized by his unwavering obedience to God. He doesn't lean on his own wisdom or strategies. He consistently seeks God's guidance and follows his commands, even when those commands seem illogical or difficult.
He's like the ultimate example of walking the walk. His actions back up his words. He doesn't just talk about trusting God. He actually lives it out, even when it's risky.
Exactly. And this obedience isn't passive or hesitant. Joshua is a man of action. He leads the Israelites into battle with courage, inspiring them to overcome their fears. He's not afraid to take risks and step out in faith, trusting that God will be with him. And he doesn't shy away from tough decisions, even when those decisions are unpopular or controversial.
His decision to spare Rahab and her family, even though she was a Canaanite prostitute, really highlights that. It took guts to go against the grain and show compassion in the midst of a war.
It certainly did. It shows us that he was a leader who valued mercy and justice even when surrounded by violence. And that commitment to righteousness isn't just a personal trait. He actively instills it in the Israelites. He's constantly reminding them to live holy lives, to obey God's laws, and to treat each other with fairness and respect.
So even though the conquest involved warfare and violence, it wasn't just about brute force. It was about laying the foundation for a society built on God's principles of justice and righteousness. But let's be real, Joshua's leadership wasn't all smooth sailing. He faced opposition, rebellions, and setbacks. Nobody's perfect, not even a leader chosen by God.
Absolutely. Every leader faces challenges and disappointments. But what sets Joshua apart is his resilience, his ability to bounce back from adversity and remain focused on the mission. He doesn't let setbacks derail him. He keeps his eyes on the prize, establishing God's people in the promised land and seeing God's kingdom flourish.
He's like the Energizer Bunny of biblical leaders. He just keeps going and going. And even though he's a strong and decisive leader, he's not afraid to ask for help and seek counsel from others. He understands the importance of teamwork and collaboration.
We see that in his interactions with the elders and the tribal leaders. He doesn't try to control everything. He delegates responsibility and empowers others to take ownership.
That's a valuable lesson for any leader, isn't it? Knowing how to build a strong team and trust the people you've placed in positions of authority. It's about recognizing that you don't have to do everything yourself.
Exactly. And it's a lesson that applies to all of us, whether we're leading a family, a business, or a nation. As we wrap up this part of our deep dive, I hope it's clear that the book of Joshua is so much more than just a dry historical account. It's a story packed with drama, intrigue, moral dilemmas, and profound theological truths. It's a story about leadership, about a man who embodied the qualities of obedience, courage, justice, resilience, and humility.
It's definitely given me a lot to think about. Joshua's example is inspiring, but it also raises some tough questions about how we navigate the complexities of leadership, faith, and obedience in our own lives. We've still got more to uncover. We'll be back soon to explore the lasting legacy of the book of Joshua, its enduring relevance for our lives today, and some final thoughts to consider as you continue your own deep dive into this fascinating book. We've journeyed through battles and moral dilemmas, explored the complexities of leadership, and grappled with some of the tougher questions the book of Joshua throws our way. But now, as we wrap up our deep dive, I'm curious to explore the bigger picture, the overarching themes, and the book's lasting relevance for us today. What are your thoughts?
Well, one theme that really stands out is the concept of covenant. We see this most clearly in those covenant renewal ceremonies at Shechem, both at the beginning and the end of Joshua's leadership. These ceremonies highlight the unique relationship between God and the Israelites. It wasn't just about following a list of rules. It was about this binding agreement, a covenant built on mutual love, loyalty, and commitment.
It's interesting, isn't it? It almost feels like a marriage, where both parties are making vows and choosing to love and honor each other day after day. But in this case, the stakes are incredibly high. It's not just about personal happiness. It's about the fate of a nation.
That's a great point. And just like in a marriage, there were consequences for breaking the covenant. The Israelites were constantly reminded that if they turned away from God, if they started chasing after other gods, they would lose those blessings and face judgment.
It's a sobering reminder that faithfulness and obedience aren't just abstract concepts. They have real-world implications. But there's another theme that's closely intertwined with this idea of covenant, the theme of inheritance. What significance do you see there?
Well, the inheritance of the land of Canaan wasn't something the Israelites earned or deserved. It was a gift, a tangible expression of God's faithfulness to his promises. It was something to be cherished and passed down through generations.
It wasn't just about acquiring property, though, was it? It was about something much deeper. They were inheriting a legacy, a spiritual identity as God's chosen people, set apart for a special purpose.
Exactly. They were called to be a holy nation, a light to the world reflecting God's character and glory to the surrounding nations. But that calling came with a huge responsibility.
It's like they were given this incredible opportunity, this privileged position, but it wasn't a free pass. They had to live up to it.
Right. They were expected to live in a way that was worthy of their inheritance, to honor God and reflect his righteousness in their lives.
So the book of Joshua isn't just a story about military conquest and settling down in a new land. It's about establishing a new society, a community grounded in God's principles and dedicated to fulfilling his purposes. And that's where the theme of leadership becomes so crucial. Joshua isn't just a military strategist. He's a spiritual leader, a guide who shapes the values and beliefs of the nation.
Right. He's constantly reminding the people of their obligations to God, urging them to obey his commands and to live holy lives. He doesn't just issue orders. He leads by example, demonstrating unwavering obedience, courage, and integrity.
He's definitely a leadership role model for any era. But even with all of that, the book of Joshua still raises some tough questions, doesn't it? We can't shy away from those. The violence and destruction in the conquest narratives, especially the concept of harem, are difficult to reconcile with our modern sensibilities.
It's true. Those are challenging aspects of the text that require us to dig deeper, to think critically, and wrestle with the complexities of faith and history. But even as we grapple with those difficult questions, there are timeless truths that shine through, truths that resonate across centuries and speak to us today.
So what are some of those enduring takeaways that we can glean from this ancient text? What can we carry with us as we finish this deep dive?
Well, for me, the book of Joshua highlights God's unwavering faithfulness to his promises. The Israelites' journey from slavery in Egypt to freedom in the Promised Land is a powerful testament to that. It reminds us that we can trust God, even when things seem impossible.
It's a message of hope and encouragement, isn't it? But it's not a passive hope. There's an active element to it, a call to respond to God's faithfulness with our own faithfulness.
Right. God's blessings are often tied to our willingness to obey him, to align our lives with his will. And that obedience isn't always easy. It often requires courage, sacrifice, and a willingness to step out in faith, even when we don't fully understand what God is doing.
Just like Joshua and the Israelites, we have to trust God's leadership and follow his guidance, even when it takes us into uncharted territory. But amidst the challenges and the battles, there's also this beautiful thread of grace woven throughout the book, isn't there?
Absolutely. The stories of Rahab and the Gibeonites are powerful reminders that God's love and mercy aren't limited to a select few. They extend to all who seek him, regardless of their background or their past mistakes. It's a message that echoes through the New Testament.
It's a message that transcends time and culture. It's a message that still speaks to us today. The book of Joshua isn't just a dusty old history book. It's a living story, full of adventure, struggle, and redemption. It's a story that invites us to grapple with our own faith, our own understanding of God, and our own place in the world.
As we wrap up our deep dive, I hope it sparked a curiosity in you, a desire to keep exploring and wrestling with the ideas we've discussed. What resonates with you? What new insights have you gained?
That's what the deep dive is all about, sparking curiosity, offering new perspectives, and encouraging deeper reflection. We've given you a lot to ponder, and we hope you continue on this journey of discovery. Thanks for joining us as we explore the world of Joshua and the conquest of Canaan.